If the natural tendencies of mankind are so bad that it is not safe to permit people to be free, how is it that the tendencies of these organizers are always good? Do the legislators and their appointed agents also belong to the human race, or do they believe they themselves are made of a finer clay than the rest of mankind? Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we'll be discussing Crimes Against Logic by Jamie White. He is a past lecturer of philosophy at Cambridge University and winner of Analysis Journalist Prestige Prize for the best article by a philosopher under 30. Mr. White, thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. As you can see, that I won that prize quite a while ago.
Yeah. What is fake news?
Fake news is stories that are presented as news that are false. And there's plenty of it. Just a little anecdote, actually. I worked in politics for a while. I was the leader of a minor political party in New Zealand, just for 1 year, because I lost the election. But in other words, that got me into the news a fair bit. And then there have been other occasions in my life where I've either been in a news story or close to a news story. And on most occasions, there were material errors in the reporting. And it occurred to me, you know, I'm in a position to know the facts in these stories, and I can see that they're getting them wrong in reasonably important ways. And so if that's happening in, you know, let's say 80% of the cases where I know facts, it's probably happening just all the time. So, and by the way, it wasn't on the whole malice on the part of the journalists. Sometimes it was, certainly it was. There were sometimes occasions, especially when I was in politics, where reporters who didn't like my views would do everything they could to distort what I said, make me seem evil and so on. But more often, they were just kind of incompetence, actually. So I think that if you're a grown-up person, you should expect there'd be a lot of error in the news, and you should, you know, take it with a grain of salt, as they say. And that's always been known. My father told me this when I was a boy, you know, you shouldn't believe everything you read in the newspapers. I think it's been common knowledge, ordinary wisdom for forever. But the idea of fake news has taken off. And I think that, you know, in some people's hands, or almost everyone's hands who uses the term, it's to suggest a conspiracy of some kind. And also to suggest a response. And that response is that the authorities should control the media in some way. You know, so what can be heard, what can be said, you know, this will all be managed by the authorities. You know, to a greater or lesser extent, we'll have something like the Ministry of Truth. And that's why I'm very opposed to the hysteria about fake news. I suggest, look, be a grown-up, learn to live with it, you know, learn how to check sources, look at more than one source, try to work out which sources are reliable, which sources are not. Just, you know, do the normal work of a responsible adult. Don't try and hand it over to give somebody power over you. To protect you, because you know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, it's really amazing. People will actually say things like, my opening quote was from 1850, an economist, Frederick Bastiat, who was basically saying, you know, you're always criticizing people and how you're pessimistic and you don't trust people, but you want this group of people to have much more power than anyone else. So it's not that I'm naive and you're living in the real world. It's just, it's more or less different playing fields where we could either have a monopoly on truth or we could have competing truth. It's not like, should things be true or should they be false? Well, of course, we all want them to be true. It's just a mechanism of determining truth from falsehood. Do you see a lot of overlap in your advocacy for free market ideas and this opposition to fake news? For example, shouldn't the state just monopolize education and healthcare and utilities, and for the same reason they shouldn't monopolize, you know, news?
Well, it's the same Actually, when you were giving the kind of the argument regarding speech, it occurred to me that exactly the same argument is often used on these other matters. So, for example, if you say, in Great Britain here, we have this thing called the National Health Service. It's the government monopoly, basically, in the supply of healthcare. I mean, you can have private alternatives, but since you get taxed to pay for the NHS, and it's offered free after the tax is paid, well, then, you know, it crowds out the private sector. Now, one of the things that, one of the interesting kind of rhetorical ploys is that if you criticize the NHS, if you say it's a dreadful arrangement, you'll present it as not caring about healthcare. As if, you know, if you were to say the government, or if you say the government shouldn't regulate education, education should just be a completely free market, like anything else. You have private suppliers offering a service to consumers that they may or may not want, and it shouldn't be regulated by the state, certainly shouldn't be supplied by the state, shouldn't even be regulated by the state. They say, oh, you don't care about standards in education. As if somehow the only source of standards could be the state. I mean, the obvious source of standards is consumers. Consumers don't want shoddy goods, right? And the problem when you move to a state, and you don't, you're gonna go out of business if you don't provide them with something they want. So the rhetoric's the reverse of the truth. The truth is that when the state gets involved, they can impose any old standards they want, whether consumers want things that way or not. Also, they tend to supply a one-size-fits-all kind of, you know, a single standard, where what you want on the whole are a variety of standards that you can choose between that compete. One thing that's not sufficiently well understood, I think, about markets, even by some people who are pro-markets, is it's not just competition between goods and services, suppliers of goods and services. There's competition between suppliers of rules, of standards. For example, a share market, you know, they have, any stock market will have rules for what you have to disclose as a business if your share is going to be listed on that stock market. That's a kind of system of rules. Now, the government comes along and regulates that stuff as well. They don't really need to. The stock markets could do it for themselves, and then we would have competition between stock markets, and it would be would get higher standards, and we get more variety. You might have one stock market that suits certain kinds of firms, large ones maybe, other markets that suit different ones, and we do see a bit of that already. But insofar as the government gets involved, they impede that kind of process. But to your point, yeah, I mean, I think as you get older, the point about that these are people, right, who are doing these things. Mike Munger's very good about this. Never say the government. Name the people who are making the decision. The government doesn't do anything, right? That guy does it. Joe Biden does it. Now, is Joe Biden a lot smarter than me? Is Joe Biden able to make better decisions for me than I can make for myself? As I say, as you get older, the mystique of the government vanishes, because some of the guys you went to school with are bigwigs in politics or something. Yeah, that guy, I mean, you know, he couldn't run a bath. Let alone a country, you know. So that's one of the few compensations of getting older. You see through these characters.
Now, one thing about market competition that I was introduced to by Jason Brennan, a philosopher at Georgetown University. He said it's not just competition, it's really competition to cooperate. In other words, in America, we have two similar stores, Home Depot and Lowe's. These are home appliance, where you'd buy wood and tools and all this wide variety of things. And yes, they are competing with each other, trying to get customers, trying to get employees and CEOs. But in order to compete, they first have to cooperate with all the people who make the metal, all the people who make the building, all the customers. They have to compete with the employees, cooperate with all the contractors. To compete, you first have to cooperate with millions of people. The ideas that Adam Smith was talking about 250 years ago. What are some other things about competition and cooperation that go unappreciated in the free market discussions?
Well, I mean, one point about if you're going to participate in a market, you have to cooperate not just with your suppliers and your customers, but to some extent with your competitors. So it's, I mean, not too much. If you get together, like Adam Smith said, and cooperate in price fixing and so on, you're harming your customers. I don't think that needs to be regulated because it can't be sustained on the whole. Someone will break ranks to get a better deal. It's very difficult to sustain cartels. But there is a sense in which you cooperate. Even the competitors cooperate, which is that, and this is going to kind of another level in a sense of what it means to cooperate. They participate in a framework of behavior that is inherently civilized. The market economy requires people to, you know, it requires peace. We all know that. So you don't want to actually go around. I don't know, the management of, I don't know, Home Depot, I remember. What's the other one you said?
Lowe's.
You know, they're not going to drive around in a pickup truck with a machine gun mounted on the back and shoot up loads, right? Stuff like that does go on in places in the world. But you know, when you get to a stable and advanced market economy, the participants in it tend to understand quite well that it benefits everybody. And you have high degrees of broad cooperation with the system, so to speak. I don't like talking about the system, but I mean, you know, certain conventions of honesty and openness and peacefulness, people go along with them because they see that it's in their benefit. David Hume wrote quite a lot about this, and this being the foundation of modern peaceful orderly societies. You only need a small amount of power at work. It could be private, it could be the police, you know, by the state, it could be private guards, something, but you don't need much if the system is, you know, operating pretty well, because people cooperate in the maintenance of the order that facilitates it. And one of the things that left-wingers, often socialists, say is that capitalism makes people bad, it makes them greedy, it makes them selfish, it makes them cruel and heartless and so on. Actually, that's the opposite of the truth. Capitalism promotes a bunch of virtues, such as being trustworthy, being open to strangers, you know, because you want to do business with them. It's kind of the opposite of tribalism. It's cosmopolitan and civilized. No non-market economies have ever been lovely places to live.
Now, when people hear capitalism, they will often assume that this is very few people either getting all the money in society, controlling the rest of us, or sometimes working with the state in order to get a monopoly. For example, in 1913 in America, Woodrow Wilson, the president, signed the Federal Reserve Act, which just gave a monopoly on money printing to the Federal Reserve Bank, which is just a private bank of people with the name Federal. What does it mean to support free market capitalism?
This is, I think, a very tricky topic. A lot of the anti-capitalist sentiment we now see was stirred up by the financial crisis of 2008. I think that if banks hadn't been bailed out by governments, and it depends, if there'd been very severe economic shock, people might have developed anti-capitalist feelings anyway. But the bailouts made people think that capitalism is a kind of a rigged system. You know, if you do well, you get the profits. If you do badly, the losses are spread across the whole of society through taxation. And I've got some sympathy with that view. Now, I don't think that's a bastardization of capitalism, that so-called crony capitalism. Some people would say it's not capitalism at all. I think there are two elements in capitalism. One is the private ownership of the means of production, and you can have that without having free markets, which is the other important element. So in the fascist regimes of the 1930s, you had private ownership of the means of production, but the government directed the use of that capital. And you had to be in with the government if you were going to get ahead, right? So you had one element of capitalism, but not the free market element. Most of us who are fans of capitalism are very fond of the free market side. But so I could just say, oh, well, that's not proper capitalism. I don't like that. But I think there's a more serious problem here, which is that there's an interaction between capitalism and democracy, which can be problematic. So in capitalism, in a free market capitalist system, it's almost impossible to avoid large accumulations of wealth, either in corporations or some individuals, right? And then, you know, then that they will naturally seek advantage through the political system. They'll lobby politicians to get tariffs put on imports from their foreign competitors, to create regulatory barriers to new competition domestically. You know, you see, and you even see it with professionals. You get these professional organizations who lobby politicians to have, you know, license, professional licensing and all that kind of thing, which just restricts competition and harms consumers. It's a really difficult problem. How do you stop that? Right? Some people say, you know, there should be limits on how much money can be spent in political campaigning, and that would help to stop it. You know, lobbyists should be registered, all sorts of things, right? All sorts of attempts to constrain it. I don't know. I must say, I don't know what the right answer is. I think part of the answer is just gutting politics. So that's to say, there are a lot of people, Tyler Cowen and some people who are apparently libertarians have talked about state capacity. They want the state to be, they want a good state. Well, I don't really. I want a gutted state. I want one that can't do anything. They're useless. There's no point lobbying them because they've got very little power. I don't want Parliament to sit. Parliament in Britain sits all the time and they pass all these laws. Well, and I've been thinking for years, how do you stop the bastards from passing laws all the time, making new laws? Well, just don't allow them to go into Parliament. Just, they only sit in Parliament, let's say, 1 week a year. So they got to decide. They're going to do just a couple of things. I mean, the idea that the United Kingdom, after 200 years of parliamentary government more, is still passing crime laws is astounding. What, we don't know what the crimes are yet? It's just stop, for God's sake. But they can't stop, right? Their job depends on not stopping. So I think, as I say, that interaction between money and politics is a problem that arises in countries that are capitalist countries. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, one thing to point out is that we libertarians and pro-capitalist people should not be utopian. A world of humans and scarcity, it's always going to be, unless we get to transhumanism, but let's suppose we're stuck with being humans and we're always going to have scarce resources, time being the most obvious example. Life's going to be imperfect. The question is, which is the best arrangement socially? And even with the problems that capitalism has in this regard, you know, the attempts to capture politicians, it still massively outperforms any alternative. We still have far better lives, much more prosperity, much more liberty. So this is an imperfection for sure, and I'd like to see the back of it. But I'd much rather live with that, like in the United States of say 10 years ago, than the alternative suggested by radicals on the left and right.
Sure. Even ideas of large capital accumulation and large wealth, that still is not a free market criticism necessarily. If you look at King Leopold, or if you look at many monarchs throughout the past, they amassed large amounts of wealth, but they didn't do it through voluntary exchange or the homesteading principle, which libertarians explicitly have been on the side of, differentiating the principal difference between just control, me making the rules for my house, and me making the rules for Africa. It's contracting with people and private property.
The alternatives, I should have said this, yes, you're quite right. The alternative arrangements, rather than viewing this nexus of money and political power as problematic and something has to be got rid of, simply build it in. So, you know, under a monarchical kind of system, you've got these people who were descended from warlords, effectively, who control masses of capital and can push people around, and they do it just directly, right? Under a communist system, all the capital in the country is controlled by the state, And some people get to the top of the greasy pole and then they, you know, deploy it for their benefit. So yes, the other systems also have, I mean, you actually kind of need a great accumulation of capital in an advanced economy, right? Because, you know, think of a nuclear power station, right? There's a lot of capital tied up in that. That's billions. And so we can't have completely, you can have fragmented ownership, but you do have to have some aggregations of the capital. And then somebody's going to control it, at least at any point in time. And do you want it to be controlled in a market kind of a way where people can buy and sell the shares in it and all that kind of thing, the normal stuff that we, or do you want the politicians to control it or kings to control it? Well, yeah, I plump for the fragmented ownership model, the transferable ownership model, and the model that's responsive to prices, because they, you know, you've got none of that stuff in the alternative systems, and you get much worse decisions made, much more oppression. Yeah. So yes, you're right. I was being too soft on the alternatives.
Now, if I am someone who simply cares about the poor and the downtrodden, I want people to have both opportunities and security when it comes to food, housing, clothing, shelter. Why should someone like this embrace the ideas of free markets?
Well, the most obvious answer is that there can be no security without prosperity. So if you take people in North Korea, they have an, in theory, egalitarian kind of system, and yet they often starve to death when the harvests fail, because the country is just so poor. I mean, even if you got rid of the theft by the Kim family, you'd probably still be a very poor country. So you need a certain level of, you just need prosperity to feel any security. And the only system that has ever made the poor anything but literally dirt poor is capitalism. There's a wonderful chart, you will have seen it, of GDP per person in the United Kingdom, The United Kingdom's the best one because you can track it way, way back. Some economists have estimated it back to about 800 AD. And basically, it's around about $800 a year for a British person on average. And it ticks along pretty flat. So edges up a little after about 1,200, it's edging up. By around 1,800, it's at about $2,000 a year. Britain at that point is the richest country in the world. That, by the way, you know, that is what? That's a little over $5 a day, which is now poverty, one of the poverty lines. Anyway, then the chart just goes, it's just extraordinary, it's just a hockey stick, it just shoots, it almost goes straight up, right? The economic progress over the last 200 years, built basically on innovation, stimulated by the capitalist system, has been astounding, unknown in all of history. The increase in incomes of the average Brit has been about 20-fold over the last 200 years. So there's no security without that prosperity that's been delivered. The other thing, you know, if you've got a flexible labor market, so, you know, it tends to be very easy to find work. You know, in countries, we've got an exceptional situation right now, but, you know, I know the United Kingdom and New Zealand, my native New Zealand, well, and they both have reasonably flexible labor markets, reasonably light regulation of it, not as light as the United States. But interestingly, if you look at countries with that kind of labor market, there's very low rates of unemployment on the whole, involuntary unemployment. And again, you want to be the best source of security to you is to be able to get a job, a paying job. I mean, you know, people may say, oh, I'd like to have a kind of social welfare safety net. Well, maybe you would, but in countries like France, they have 10% persistent unemployment. And a lot of people, though they're fed, it's not a very dignified way of life, and they become extremely despondent. And I'd much rather live in a place where I had a good chance of getting a job if I really wanted to work. Maybe not a great job, but a job, you know. I earn my own money at the end of the day. I have my self-respect. And that's I think, the best source of it. I will say one thing. I think there's an argument. It's complicated. I'll try and run it quickly. There's a libertarian kind of an argument for a kind of social welfare. Now, let me give it to you. I got it from Stephen Landsberg, but it's a kind of a, it's a variation of a, of the John Rawls kind of approach to things, but it's not Rawlsian except in one regard. So he says, imagine you know you're going to be born. You're not born yet. You're a kind of soul floating around. You're going to be born. But you don't know the circumstances of your birth. You don't know whether you're going to have nice parents or nasty parents. You don't know if you're going to be smart or dumb, or maybe you're going to be physically disabled or something like that, right? So you would, as a pre-birth soul, you might want to buy a bad birth insurance. But you can't, right? Because, you know, you can't do anything before you're born, and there's no market serving the unborn. And so, and the way, but what would happen if you did buy it is that you would pay your premiums after you were born. And so if you had a good birth and everything worked out for you, that's fine. You pay the premiums, you never get a payout from your insurance. But if things are bad for you at birth, well, then you do get a payout, right? Now, you could say that the social welfare systems of the type they have in, let's say, Sweden or whatever, are providing that bad birth insurance in a kind of roundabout way. And that what they're doing there is correcting a market failure. Be careful here. When I say market failure, I mean a failure of a market to exist. I don't mean a failure within a market. There is no market for the reasons I explained to you. There can't be. That is an argument. Now, there's a, so I, and I think that I would want bad birth insurance, but here's a, it's not a counter argument, but it's a qualification. That argument doesn't entail that it has to be supplied by the state. So you could say, look, yeah, people, that's how people are. People would want that insurance. But it doesn't mean the state needs to supply it. You know, before the state got involved in all this stuff, there was, people looked after the less fortunate in their society. They did it voluntarily. And voluntary mechanisms are better for a variety of reasons, because, well, mainly because so much more judgment can be brought to bear. You know, charity dispensed privately tends to engage much more directly with the individual and their real issues. State charity, so to speak, tends to work on a brute entitlement basis. And a lot of people who don't really, wouldn't really qualify for that insurance. You see what I mean? They didn't actually have a bad birth, but they nonetheless draw on the system. So I would want some kind of a safety net, but I don't know that I want it provided by the state.
Sure, just like many other things. I want food, housing, technology, clothing, friends, places to shop. That doesn't necessarily mean I want a group of people coercively funding it. I would want voluntarily funded competition that you can disassociate from if they're not actually helping the poor, if they're not really lifting people up and giving them the opportunities. Mutual aid societies, of course, were great places in fraternities in Britain and the US. They also had some sort of camaraderie. But the state is constantly trying to make you dependent on them, turn you against your neighbors. Everyone you know is a racist or a bigot or someone out to screw you. So you can only trust us. So, of course, they have every incentive to bash the churches. So they're the only authority in town. And, of course, mutual aid society since the days of Otto von Bismarck, they've been trying to bash just because they don't want any competing authorities and want you to be dependent on them. So, yes, I do like that argument, just like I like a lot of the sympathetic arguments people have, but none of them justify certainly state intervention in what otherwise could be a voluntary exchange.
Yeah, I think foreign aid is an interesting case here. I mean, you know, there was, in Britain, a previous government committed to a policy that few countries have, which was to give 0.7% of GDP in foreign aid. This was some kind of UN request. Everybody should do that. And Britain signed up to it. The government was signing up to it as a show of being a compassionate. They were the Conservative Party, but they were making a show of being compassionate and caring. And of course, it's not at all compassionate comparing to the people who you're taking the money from. But interestingly, it's also not really that compassionate and caring to the people who receive it, because there's a lot of evidence that foreign aid administered by governments does more harm than good in the recipient countries. It's a show of caring without any actual caring going on. And there's absolutely no need for the government to get involved. Private, many people, me, I know many people who give money to poor Africans, let's say, right? I mean, there's no need for the government to get involved in this. And yet they do. And the beneficiary is almost entirely the people who administer the programs. My wife's African, and she says that you get these aid organizations driving around in poor parts of Africa in their luxury cars, staying in the luxury hotels. And you can tell that about 90% of the budget's going on there.
It is, yeah. And, you know, basically, if a country has poor institutions, anti-private property, anti-voluntary exchange, what the foreign aid does is sometimes prop up those regimes and make things worse than they otherwise would have been. So it strengthens the worst parts of that society. Are you familiar with any countries becoming wealthy as the result of foreign aid? I'm just thinking of Britain, America, Singapore, Japan, the places that I would want to live, Luxembourg. Did any of them become wealthy because of foreign aid or that kind of thing?
I mean, the only case, and it would be tendentious, I think, but the only one you might argue is Germany after World War II. There was a lot of Marshall Fund money going in. But that's a ridiculous thing to say because it was a rich country that had been devastated by war. It wasn't a country that needed to kind of go through that process that you go through. You know, all the countries that got rich went through of independently doing it. So it had everything in place. It had, you know, so I don't think that's a real case. But I mean, most people say the Marshall Program was a success. It involved a transfer of money from the United States to Germany after World War II. But I don't think it, in any sense, you can't say, look, that's what created modern Germany. You know, modern Germany had already come into being.
Or you could look at East Germany versus West Germany and look at the results of those two economic systems. Certainly, the more free market system had better results. I mean, that talk about a scientific experiment. Well, it's impossible to compare, you know, Britain to the Soviet Union. They're so different. But North Korea, South Korea, Botswana and Zimbabwe, East Germany and West Germany, Chile and Venezuela, those are at least, you know, relatively comparable. But the pro-science people really don't want any scientific experiments.
Those Venezuela and North Korea and East Germany, well, they would have worked if only they hadn't been undermined by capitalist saboteurs of the system.
Oh, so they're admitting that economic regulation stops people from prospering. Thank you. They finally admitted it. Yes, it actually is true.
Look, there's a guy, I used to work at the Institute of Economic Affairs where I was the director of research, and a chap who worked in my research team there, Christian Niemitz, who you might want to get on the show, he's very good value. He wrote a book while I was there called Socialism, the Failed Idea That Never Dies, or something like that. And he goes through, he says, look, it's about the Western intellectuals' response to left-wing intellectual response to socialist experiments around the world. And he says they have an absolutely regular pattern, and he shows it in case after case. Each chapter is devoted to one of these things. So Soviet Union is the first one. He says at first they go, this is finally, here it is, the socialist model that we all wanted. It's going to be great. And they sing its praises. Then it becomes clear that it's not working out too well. They start making excuses for it. They say it's being undermined by American foreign policy or trade barriers or you name it, all these kinds of things. Then when it's really completely gone to crap, they say, oh, it was never socialism in the first place. They disown it completely. And so, you know, you've heard the slogan, socialism, real socialism has never been tried. That's they always end up there. And what they can't seem, they either say it wasn't real socialism, you know, the model wasn't exactly right, or it was undermined by these foreigners, or bad people hijacked it, right? Like Stalin, you know, he's a bad guy, Mao's a bad guy. And what they can't seem to explain or face is the fact that these things go wrong, that these things always go wrong, is a structural feature of it. It's inherent to it. It's not a kind of accident. It just so happened that in these seven or eight cases, you know, went wrong. It has to go wrong, and it has to go wrong in really nasty ways that involve, you know, horrific oppression of people, often slaughter. And I think the best chapter of Niemitz's book is the first one, when before he gets onto each case, he explains why it has to go wrong in the ways that it always does go wrong. And he explains that beautifully. I recommend that chapter of the book. And Niemitz is very funny at mocking socialists. His Twitter account is just an endless mockery of modern day socialists and their stupidity.
Well,
but it's dangerous stupidity is the problem. It's very dangerous stupidity.
Certainly in the case of Venezuela, it's harder with, you know, the North Korea, because it was so long ago. With Venezuela, we have a lot of cameras and articles by Noam Chomsky, Sean Penn, Michael Moore, the usual suspects. They're like, fine, look at Hugo Chavez. Look, an example of a group of people finally getting together and coming together for workers' rights. And now they just pretend, and now they just mock us. They're like, oh, you're probably going to bring up Venezuela. And I go, well, it's worth mentioning that. And they go, oh, see, yeah. I knew you'd bring that up. Yeah, you know what? I am gonna bring that up.
This is actually, it's a really bizarre argumentative ploy. So, I had a girlfriend when I was a PhD student, and she was more into the kind of postmodernist type of wibble wobble. And they would make some kind of, she'd make some relativist type comments, or somebody in a talk we were at would make them. And I would say, well, you know, if it's if Uranus didn't exist, the planet, you know, until it was discovered, and or until it was invented, because of course they believe that scientific facts are invented, not discovered. I said that you have a bit of a problem there, because how are you going to explain that the orbits of the other planets, if Uranus wasn't there, because it exerts a gravitational pull on them, and so if you say it didn't exist until that date, you've got an anomaly previously. In fact, of course, that's how they discovered that it existed, because there was an anomaly. But anyway, I would bring up points like that, and they would roll their eyes. Oh, such a predictable, tedious objection. Because, well, yes, it is predictable, because your position's ridiculous, and basic facts show it to be wrong. But the odd thing was that they held it against you, that you were invoking basic and very familiar facts to refute their theory. That somehow was a problem for me, because I'm being boring. and they've got this really exciting and interesting view. And, you know, I would have to, the right way to refute these positions, when they're playing the game amongst themselves, it's very interesting to watch them playing amongst themselves. How do you show that one of these guys making the talk is wrong? Because you might want to do that. You know, you're a PhD student, maybe, and you can get some kudos by showing that the visiting scholars is wrong. But you've got to play by the rules of that world. And the rules of that world, you would have to say that there was inherent in this view of his some kind of underlying misogyny, perhaps, or something like that. Or you have to excavate some deep, something bad that's lurking in the view that isn't obvious, but I can show you that really it is implicit in there. And that's how they kind of proceed. It's a bizarre, bizarre game. And it's not, as far as I can tell, in any way aimed at trying to understand reality. It's got nothing, it's nothing like ordinary science or honest philosophy. It's an entirely different enterprise, a bizarre game. And, you know, for an outsider to come and sit in on one of these seminars, you'd just be utterly bewildered. You would have no idea what was going on.
Unbelievable stuff. That's what I like so much about Crimes Against Logic, your book. I want to get into it. You start off by talking about the importance of knowing rights and duties. Why is it important to know rights and duties?
Well, that was in a chapter on the idea that you have a right to your own opinion. This is a common view that you hear it all the time. And I wanted to explain why that was false. But the best way, I think, to understand why, when people claim rights, how to test whether they really have the right or not, is to understand that rights entail duties. Now, this doesn't mean, if you have the right to free speech, you have the duty to use it carefully. I don't mean that. That's what some people mean. No, it's something much more fundamental. If I have a right to life, then everybody else has a duty not to kill me. Right? That rights entail corresponding duties, flip side duties, you might say, right? So if you and I enter a contract, an employment contract, let's say, suppose you promise to pay me $100 a week if I come and make your bed every day. Well, if I do make your bed every day, I have a right to $100, means you have a duty to pay me $100. Right? Now, so there's always a corresponding right. So take the right to life. Again, to see what people mean by a right, you've got to ask what duties does it entail? So for example, the way I said I have a right to life, I said that you have a duty not to kill me. That's a so-called negative interpretation of the right. That it doesn't, I'm not suggesting that you have a duty to feed me. Right? You don't have to keep me alive, you just have to not kill me. If you had a duty to feed me, then my right to life would be a more substantial right, it would be an entitlement in a sense. I have a claim against you that you provide me with what I need to live. And indeed, many people think that we do have such a right and that the claim is against the state. So what you've always got to ask yourself, when somebody claims that they've got a right to this or to that, you go, well, what are the corresponding duties? And you can sum up utterly absurd. The United Nations is endlessly declaring rights. And one of the rights it's declared is that every child has a right to be loved. Well, I think it's nice if children are loved, but who has a duty to love every child? Who, indeed, does anyone have a duty to love any child? I mean, is love that kind of thing? Can I love you as a matter of duty? It's just crazy talk that you have a right to be loved. They just mean we think it would be nice if all children were loved, but that's not a right. Now, take the right to your own opinion. People say you have a right to their opinion. What does that mean? Does that mean I have a duty to believe what you say? I have a duty to let you say it, yes, right? But that is a duty, that is a right to express your opinion. That's not a right to hold your opinion. If I argue with you and I prove you wrong and you are forced by the mere reason to change your opinion, right? So I would have violated your right to hold your opinion, right? Because you know, you've got a right to hold your opinion and I've taken your opinion away from you through force of reason or counter evidence. And indeed, they appeal to this right. At that point in an argument, we've got the better of them, right? So when you've got the better of something, I have the right to my opinion. By the way, this all sounds like mere silliness, but it's not, you know, this idea that we have a right to our, here's a tension. People can't have both a right to their opinion and a right to express their opinion. Because if you have a right to your opinion and my expressing my opinions would make you lose your opinion, right? Then by my expressing my opinion, I've violated your right to hold your opinion. And you do indeed see many people saying that we shouldn't be allowed to express our opinions when they challenge other people's opinions, because other people have got a right to those opinions. They don't say it universally, they just say it on certain topics like, you know, religion and issues of identity and so on. I mean, in Britain now, this isn't yet true, but the police, one of the police forces in Britain, the Merseyside, it's the police force of Liverpool, the city, the photos started doing the rounds on Twitter and elsewhere. There they were with a van, and they had a big placard built onto the side of the van going up into the air. And it had the rainbow flag. You know, it used to be LGBT plus flag. Now they've added a black and brown line to include racial elements as well. So it's, I don't know what it even means. It's got an all-purpose flag for, I don't know. But we all do know, right? I don't know how to put it exactly, but we all know. Anyway, and on the side, the police had written, being offensive is an offense, meaning a criminal offense, right? That's not true in Britain yet, but the police act as if it's true. For example, there was a group of women, feminists of the, trans-exclusionary variety, who had put up posters, again, I think it was in Liverpool, declaring that women do not have penises. This is what they wrote. And the police investigated them for a hate crime. And it's, so why are they not allowed to say that? Well, because this opinion that some women have penises is not to be challenged. It's considered beyond, you mustn't challenge that view. If you say very rude things about Islam in Britain, you can get in trouble. Do you know about the comedian who got in Scotland who got convicted of a hate crime for a joke?
I know about the guy in Canada, not Scotland.
There's a guy in Scotland. His name's he's a comedian. His name's Count Dankula.
He made his dog.
He taught his dog to do a Hitler salute whenever he said the words "burn the Jews." And this was a joke at the expense of his girlfriend. She'd gone away, and she was a very politically correct type, very woke, and she'd gone away on a holiday, and he trained the dog while she was away, just for the sake of appalling her, right? He's a pretty woke guy himself. You may think it's a tasteless joke, but it was very clearly intended as a joke, and a joke at the expense of his girlfriend, not at the expense of Jews. Anyway, he got fined. He's got a conviction. He's a criminal. He's a convicted criminal. I think this idea that people have a right, it's started coming along. These ideas have been brewing for a long time. You know, they're in my book, and my book was published in 2003 originally, the British version. You've got the 2004 American version. And they were so familiar to me, these ideas, that I could write that book up pretty quickly. The seeds of what we're seeing now were planted long ago.
Yeah.
If you reread my book, you'll see that a lot of the stuff that's going on now, I'm talking about it back then. It wasn't, the difference back then was, it wasn't a dangerous environment. After I wrote that book, the comment editor of the Times, the British Times, not the New York Times, the London one, contacted me and said, would you like to contribute comment articles to my, to the Times? And I did for several years. And I wrote stuff that was pretty controversial, I suppose, by modern standards, but it never occurred to me that I was going to get in trouble for it or cancelled in some way, and I never did. Nobody ever, said anything. And the Times was happy to keep running my articles because I always made an argument to make it clear. Now, I pulled an article I'd written the other day, actually. I'd written it, I was happy with it was going to be published in a leading British magazine, and I showed it to some friends and they said, you can't publish that. You'll lose all your contracts. I make my money through commercial writing for companies, well, at the moment I am. And they said, you'll get canceled. You'll lose all your contracts. Because I challenged the identity, the culture of identity quotas and all that kind of thing within the corporate world. So it's a complete, although, as I said, the ideas have been blowing around for long time, but the intolerance around them is new. That's really exploded in the last 5 years.
That's unbelievable. They'll always say you're saying something that could be linked to racism. People talk about racism, then they could believe it, and then this could lead to people's rights being violated while they advocate socialism and statism and regulation, the most violent, murderous Marxist ideologies that have ever existed. I mean, they can't even hear their own words.
Our British equivalent of Bernie Sanders is a chap called Jeremy Corbyn. He's the leader of the Labour Party. He's a total socialist, a proper. There's no doubt about that.
He was a Hugo Chavez supporter.
Oh, huge. Yeah. You name the foreign kind of dictator. Provided they're anti-American, Corbyn likes them. So Corbyn is an out-and-out socialist, an out-and-out friend of terrible dictators and things. Nobody ever complained about that. No. The way Corbyn was ultimately kind of run out of town is that they trumped up some idea that he was anti-Semitic. Which he may be a little bit, I don't know, maybe, I don't really think so. He's certainly pro-Palestine, but to what extent he's anti-Semitic, I don't know. you know, he always pleaded that he hates racism, and I think he really does. But I mean, what was amazing to me is, why are we quibbling about this? The man's a communist. He's openly a communist. Do we really have to struggle to work out if he is or isn't anti-Semitic when he's openly a communist? It's like saying, you know, you've got a guy in court, you know, he's admitted to murder and rape, and you're trying to get him on jaywalking. It's crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. The whole Palestinian cause, certainly, the reason they keep lining up on the Black Lives Matter or LGBTQ, after the income inequality arguments don't work out the way they'd like, and they can't divide people based on class, then they'll divide them on race. Why does this government need tons and tons of power? Because of the bourgeoisie, and we the proletariat are going to have a dictatorship. Why does the U.S. government need tons of power? Because of the terrible racists. Even though if you look at the statistics, black on white crime is much higher than white on black. So, I mean, that's just to say the justification they're using. They do it in foreign policy all the time. They'll just say, we were hated for no reason just because we're free, while completely ignoring the sanctions and bombings that the government has engaged in. They just create an enemy, and that's how the socialists and statists, both left and right-wing statists, use it to justify their own concentrations of power.
Yeah, they keep changing the question or the problem that needs to be solved by the same thing, which is them having a lot of power over everybody. But you know, at the moment, I think there are two. It used to be economic. It used to be capitalism impoverishes the worker. Now, that just clearly was not true. So the 19th century put an end to that. Then there was more kind of egalitarian stuff. We need more equality. There are various reasons why, I mean, you could still run those arguments. I'm actually writing something about that at the moment. I mean, the main reason is that if the poor are getting a lot richer, equality arguments kind of fizzle out. They don't matter much. But now you've got, now it's all getting a bit more, at least I liked those old school socialists more, because at least you kind of knew what they were talking about. It was concrete stuff. Workers are poor. They die young. They work in horrible conditions. We want them to be better off. I understand that. But now things are getting kind of metaphysical. I mean, so what are the problems in American society? Oh, it's whiteness. Well, what the hell is whiteness? I mean, because whiteness, by the way, is not just being a white person. You've got internalized whiteness amongst Asians. You've got all sorts of stuff going on. To even understand what the issue is, you got to do a university course in the crazy metaphysics of it. But I think, nonetheless, it's this is how I'd characterize it. You've got this idea, and it's been pushed by the BLM movement and by the trans rights thing, which is that there's a kind of pervasive, they call it structural, a pervasive evil, actually, in society. It's kind of an evil. And you can't see it necessarily. You may actually be infected by it, but you don't know it. And you need to go and get some counts. You need to get someone to reveal to you your implicit, your internalized bias and all that kind of thing. It's really quasi-religious. So you've got that threat, and it needs society to be completely restructured, completely made over from head to toe, which of course requires massive government intervention. It's not going to happen on its own. So now we've also got another thing going on, and they're often the same people in both camps. We have two existential threats we face. One is the coronavirus. It's going to kill everyone. Again, you can't really see it. It's a bit vague, but you know, it's real. I mean, I do believe it's real. But anyway, it's a terrible threat. It's not just a threat. It's a terrible threat. And then climate change, of course, which is another terrible threat. And again, conveniently, both require, well, its claims require, massive interventions in our lives with our liberties, and it's always the same people who jump on these things. And you can't help but get the feeling that what they want is the massive intervention, and they're just looking for the reason. And these things are harder and harder to argue with because they're more and more vague and metaphysical. And you're accused of wickedness if you deny the phenomenon, right? So if you do not, if you say America is not as racist as being made out, if you point out the statistics that you just did, we're not even going to talk to you. Don't even have to listen to you.
Which is ridiculous. It's the equivalent of me saying male on female violence is more prevalent than female on male violence. Okay, is that just me? Okay, now what are you going to call me? I was racist a second ago. that one, but that there's no difference in principle. I'm sorry. Well, again, that no, pisses me off. You were talking about climate.
I'm finished with the point. But you just remind me in my book that you've got there. One of the chapters concerns, I think it's called Shut Up. It's just called Shut Up, the chapter. And it concerns ploys that people use, not to show that you're wrong, but to shut you up in an argument. And I talk about, there are things, for example, you're allowed to say what you just said, that, you know, men account for most violence in society. Male and female violence is much worse than female and male violence. You're allowed to say that. You're not allowed to say, actually, you know, the police handling of black criminals is proportionate in some sense. You know, I think American policing is far too violent altogether, but that's another matter. But anyway, you're not allowed to say that. You are allowed to say that one, you're not allowed to say that one. You changing gender is fine, but changing race is terrible. I don't know why is that. I don't know. But the funny thing is, although you don't know why one's acceptable and one's not, you do know what you're allowed to say and what you're not. I mean, if you keep up, right, you know the rules. Even if the rules are completely arbitrary, you do know them. And it's funny. And we know also it's got something to do with who's perceived as victims. And I think one of the reasons that a lot of feminists are very angry about the transgender thing is the parallel with race comes in there. So why is it wrong for a white person to pass as black? Because blacks have been victims and are disadvantaged. And it's wrong for you to get the advantages of being recognized as disadvantaged when you weren't really disadvantaged, right? Now, that's why it's no good to go from white to black. And why feminists are angry that men are turning into women is because it's not fair for you to get the advantages of being recognized as a woman, which is disadvantaged, when you didn't have the disadvantages of growing up a woman. I think that's kind of the logic. That's why, and so feminists are screaming that the trans movement shows a hatred, shows a contempt for women. But why does it? Well, because it's not recognizing their real disadvantages that come from being a woman. And I think, for example, I think it's considered okay, sad, but not immoral for a black to try and pass as white. That used to happen quite a lot.
Yeah.
And people used to not see the person as being wicked. They saw them as responding to social pressures that they shouldn't have had to, and it was a sad event. But they see someone going from white to black as being an immoral thing to do, worthy of condemnation. It's very complicated, but it's all got to do with the fact that being a victim now is a high status. It's a high status thing, and people are jealous of that status. In New Zealand, where I'm from, Maori, you're allowed to. You've got your identity on a census. You've got your it's called your ethnicity of birth and your ethnicity of identity. And many white people now identify as Maori. I think there are two reasons there. It's not so much in that case that they want the victim state. It's that they want, it means you're more of a genuine New Zealander. It's a kind of national identification thing. It's an interesting phenomenon. My sister, in fact, was a Maori by identification.
By identification. Yeah, definitely you see the socialists issuing people identities and reasons to really be part of something. You want to be part of saving the world? Take the vaccine. You want to be part of saving the world? Fight climate change. Fight the melting of the ozone layer. We can fight inequality, fight racism. And instead of actually taking Ayn Rand wrote a great essay on racism in 1963 called Racism, and it says how it's important to judge people not based on arbitrary characteristics, but on their character and whether or not they engage in reason, the highest human faculty. It's the smartest thing I've ever
heard. Sounds like Martin Luther King.
Exactly. It's more eloquent than anything I've ever heard at all the BLM rallies combined, because it's just about creating an oppressor oppressed and using this as a justification to increase state power every single time.
See, what you're just spouting white patriarchal ideology here. All these ideas of universalism and individualism and so on, that's just they've got no claim on any, they've got on being the truth. They're just that's just the white patriarchy expressing itself. And the only reason you peddle all those ideas is you benefit from them. Don't you know?
And the amazing thing is they do that without the sense of irony that they're actually engaged in racism and sexism when they say something like that. They judge people primarily based on their race and gender, and we're the ones holding people accountable by some system of meritocracy, whether they support voluntary exchange, whether they work hard. That's evil. Judging people by their race or skin color, that's a good thing. Everything.
What defense will they have if the white supremacists who are out there get the upper hand and start saying, well, there's no rights don't attach to the individual, they attach to the group, and you're not in the main group now. So back to the bloody cotton plantation with you. These ideas, these ideas from the Enlightenment about the dignity of the individual, so they were the foundation of emancipation, the emancipation of women, the emancipation of blacks, the emancipation of homosexuals. And to see these groups now rejecting this ideology is astounding to me, really astounding to me. I don't really get it. Let me run it by you. I was just having it the other night. It's one of these new thoughts, and I don't know if it's any good. But I was thinking, you mentioned earlier all these friendly societies, mutual societies, and so on, the church, or these social, non-governmental, but communal organizations, right, where people voluntarily came together in certain kinds of association. And even clubs, sports clubs. Now, they've all been crowded out. They're all dying off, right? Even sports club membership is down in most countries that I'm aware of. And certainly church attendance in most countries is way down, and friendly societies, things like Rotary clubs and all that kind of thing, it's all fading away. And one of the reasons is that those organizations were sources of, they were non-governmental sources of support. The church was the first administrator of welfare, really, next to the family. And even the family's broken down, right? So what the state, the welfare state, crowds out private alternatives, because you're forced to pay the state, and then it provides a service for free. So how can private organizations compete with that? Even the family has suffered, because your parents aren't you've got the state to turn to. Not doesn't have to be your parents. Okay, so you got all that. But now you don't have all these other organizations. It's just you and your little nuclear family, maybe. But life lacks a bit of meaning. These other organizations, they used to give you some meaning and some purpose and a sense of engagement with the world and some personal dignity arising out of it. And if I wanted to express my values, I would do it through those organizations. Right? What do I do it through now? I gotta do it through, where do I get my sense of identity and meaning in life? That's gotta be done through the bloody state. It doesn't work, right? Because it's too impersonal, it's too remote. But everybody's lobbying to get the state to embody their values. And because the state's become the kind of only vehicle for the expression of these values. And I wouldn't need to do that if there were more intermediary organizations around. And if I didn't naturally turn to the state to solve all my problems. So I think that this kind of squabbling, so what I'm getting at here is on the right, there's a new illiberal movement. They're called post-liberals. And, you know, you saw them associated with Trump, some of them, and they want the state to not be neutral on matters of value and the good life. They want an activist state that promotes morals and certain social values and so on. I mean, this is abhorrent to us libertarians, but what I'm getting at here is the reason I think there's a growing demand for the state to be like that is because the state's actually killed off all the alternative channels through which we might express those feelings. And we've got, you know, the idea of the atomized individual, just there's truth in it. And it's people are sad and they lack meaning in their lives. But the idea that the state is the answer to that is the opposite of the truth. The state's what's brought about that horrible situation by crowding out and thereby killing off, I'll call them intermediary social entities.
Yeah, certainly what I, excuse me, mentioned earlier is states really hate competing authorities. They do have to be the monopoly authority. Because if the state tells me you have to, it's okay for us to regulate these people engaging in voluntary interactions, I might say, whether it's right or wrong, I might say, yeah, but my family always taught me to respect people so long as they're not harming anyone else. My church always taught me A, B, and C. My community, what I learned from my coach at soccer practice is those are just competing authorities. So they will then weigh what they've learned against what the politicians are telling them and the, you know, powers that be, whatever they are at the time. So that's why they absolutely have to crowd that out. One of the worst examples was in America, in the south part of Texas, Waco. There was a church that they wanted to have a show of force at, and things sort of went wrong. They ended up getting so scared because they were going to defend themselves. They ended up shooting into the church, killing a couple kids, stood out there for 51 days, and on day 51 went in and lit the place on fire with CS gas banned by the Geneva Conventions. That is the extent they will go to make sure we are the ones in charge. Let's be very clear. You cannot resist us. We are calling the shots here. That's what a monopoly on violence really, really is. So yeah, they certainly always take those out. And people definitely find identity. You know, here I am, just me doing whatever with my life. Maybe I'm a barista, but if I join this group, I'm fighting against the evils of racism. I'm fighting against Donald Trump, Hitler 2.0. This is the guy. I'm now part of something that really, really matters. And there's such a low buy-in. I'm pro-black, anti-white. I'm pro-poor, anti-Wall Street. It's such a low buy-in. That's so easy. It's a lot harder to grasp the principles of Ludwig von Mises's human action. So it's low buy-in. They get the identity, and the state has the symbiotic relationship of it destroying competing authorities or allegiances.